nation. Certainly, the total question of the leadership of social movements is one which is very large, perhaps one which should have a conference all to itself. For this reason, and many others, I shall refer only to the Bund. Perhaps you would also note that the word problem was eliminated. This was done because the meaning of the term was vague. It was not wholly certain whether we meant the problems which the leaders of the Bund faced in their own work, or the problems which the authors faced in trying to deal with the leadership of the Bund. We performed this minor surgery in the interests of clarity. I should also like to acknowledge at the outset that the use of the first person plural throughout the paper is not an editorial device designed to ensure anonymity, but a true description of authorship. Dr. Charles E. Woodhouse of the Department of Sociology of the University of New Mexico has participated in the conception and execution of the project from the outset, so that it is a joint work in the fullest sense of the word. The Bund and its antecedents represented a new phenomenon in the life of the Jewish community of the Russian Empire. The goals of the new movement and the spirit they engendered, coupled with the methods employed to attain them, contrasted sharply with the traditional, openly expressed patterns of Jewish life. From the depths of the Jewish masses, the spectacle emerged of Jewish workers combating their employers through the medium of strikes. These became ever more widespread from the 1880s on. By the early 1890s, the Jewish workers had even begun to take part in the celebration of political holidays, such as May 1st, and had entered the secret circles of the intelligentsia in small numbers. The appearance of Jewish intellectuals in sympathy with the plight and aims of the workers and bearing the socialist word upon their standards also dates from the late 1880s, although one can point to sporadic and isolated efforts made to interest the Jews in revolution even earlier. Direct contact between these intellectuals and Jewish workers dates from the early 1890s. It is the simultaneous growth of a popular workers' movement and a sympathetic group of intellectuals which underlay the creation of the Bund. The Bund put forth a set of radical goals. The leaders wanted to convey the message of revolutionary Marxism to the working class. They wished to break the isolation of the Jewish worker and to tie his fate to that of workers of other nationalities within the Russian Empire. They gave both practical and ideological support to the workers in their opposition to employers, a challenge of one part of the Jewish community to another part. This point holds true, of course, to the extent that the economic demands of the workers conflicted with the habits and desires of their Jewish employers. On the other hand, the leaders suggested at the outset that the whole Jewish community should seek civil equality and democratic rights within Russia. Finally, the leaders asked the Jewish workers to oppose the state openly and work for its overthrow. The new conditions fostered by the Bund's adherence to Marxism, the militancy of the Jewish worker, and the specific conditions of political existence within the Russian Empire demanded resources and responses for which little precedent existed in the Jewish community. The leaders had to solve the problem of communication with the masses. They chose Yiddish, the everyday idiom of speech, as their language, rather than Hebrew, the learned and religious medium, or Russian, the language of the society at large. They had to provide a terminology to convey the new ideas and create a literature to transmit them. Because of their own educational and oft-times cultural distance from the workers, the leaders had to form a cadre which could communicate with the workers and show them how to implement their goals. The cultural and psychological implications of these tasks were enormous. In addition to communication factors, political conditions in Russia dictated that the movement take on an illegal form. Illegality was not new in the relations between the Jewish community and Russian officialdom. Bribery, for instance, had long existed as a modus vivendi for easing the legal disabilities which Russian Jews suffered. The Bund's illegal activity, however, had the overthrow of the regime as its goal. Under these circumstances, police reprisals were constant and measures to avoid them had to be devised. The Jewish revolutionaries borrowed tactical and organizational pages from the experiences of their Russian and Polish counterparts, added practices which existed among the Jews, and placed all in a setting suited to their own times and surroundings. These communicative and organizational activities performed by the Bund may be divided into executive, technical, and intellectual categories. When we use the term executive, we mean the administrative tasks of coordinating local groups with a center, of operating according to local conditions, and the give and take of intra-organizational communication. Such activities formed a significant portion of the work of the local and central leadership of the Bund. The technical aspects of organization, the physical preparation of meetings, the printing of newspapers, pamphlets, and leaflets and their distribution, the gathering of funds, all required a legion of silent, dedicated activists. The intellectual aspects of the movement included constant formulation and reformulation of the program and policies. The leaders had to cope constantly on an intellectual plane with internal differences and, far more seriously, with opponents inside the revolutionary movement and outside of it. The communication of these matters required a set of persons prepared to deal in writing and on the public forum with a wide range of problems running the gamut from high-level political discussions to agitation in its simplest form. The apparatus which made possible the fulfillment of these tasks, the practical expression of the movement, was the organization of the Bund. The organization which the Bund developed has earned an honored place in the history of the Russian revolutionary movement. The choice of Minsk as the meeting place for the first Congress of the RSDWP in 1898 is one example of such recognition. Post-revolutionary evaluations continued to extol the excellence of the organization. Moshe Rafis, an ex-Bundist who remained with the communists after the revolution and who wrote one of the best-known histories of the Bund, noted in 1923 that the Bund, in its organizational skills and cohesion, needed to concede first place only to the Bolsheviki, and to them only in the last decade, that is, 1913 to 23. Perhaps due to an oversight, perhaps not, the statement remained unchanged in the revised edition which appeared in Yiddish in 1929. Because of its effectiveness, the Bund's organization merits the attention of historian and social scientists. However, the concept of the Bund as a formal organization sometimes runs afoul of the concept of the Bund as a movement. As early as 1904, Vladimir Akimov attempted to analyze the formal organization of social democratic groups in various Russian cities. This work was criticized by a member of the Bund Central Committee in a discussion with him. Akimov was told that he was thinking in bureaucratic terms, that what he wrote was, quote, as true as the fact that we walk on two legs, unquote, but that it bore no resemblance to the living reality. Akimov's note on the incident ends with a statement that despite the difficulties involved, he believed in the value of studying formal organization. To formulate the general principles of the organization of the Bund is not only possible, he concluded, but even necessary to support consciously the trends of its healthy development and to liquidate the outlived ones. On the one hand, the representative of the Central Committee spoke from his experience in the arena where he relied upon a spirit of trust and cooperation. It left him with little interest for the study of formal structure. On the other hand, Akimov's ordering of objective data led him to assert the practical value of his labors. We accept Akimov's notion that analysis of the observable and measurable is possible and valuable. Our purpose, however, differs from his. We wish to account for the distinctiveness of the Bund, and this purpose can be accomplished by analyzing it in a way that makes it possible to compare its organization with that of other parties. When we define the Bund as a movement, we recognize the attraction of people to ideals and goals which bind them together in a spirit of trust and dedication. These manifestations may be distinguished from the structure of formal institutions, such as congresses and committees. The Bundes themselves realize the usefulness of quantification and comparison at their 11th Congress, or I should say conference, in 1919, when they distributed questionnaires to the delegates which sought information regarding their age, occupation, education, length of party service, and various other similar matters. In short, the study of organization does not detract from the importance of the Bund as a movement. On the contrary, it may enrich our understanding of it. When the Bund is studied as an organization, rather than simply as a movement, we direct our attention to the division of labor that was necessary if the purposes of the movement were to be achieved and the various tasks executed reliably. These tasks differed in the talents they required, and not everyone attracted to the organization could be equally proficient or equally equipped to perform them all. Likewise, since the movement aimed to enlist mass support and participation, the persons drawn into the organization would differ considerably in background and experience. Thus, the organization formed by the Bund was determined in its character partly by the type of people who first assumed leadership. Yet, at the same time, the necessary division of labor determined the type of people who could be relied upon in leadership positions. In order to understand the Bund as an organization, it is necessary first to describe the differences among its leaders. We have begun to single out these differences by an intensive and systematic examination of individual biographies, of which 154 have been found useful and relevant up to this time. The biographies are of persons who were active in the organization between the founding of the Bund in 1897 and the March Revolution of 1917. These constitute the sample of active Bund members on which our analysis is based. The active participants can be distinguished in three ways. First, we have drawn distinctions between levels of formal responsibility in the organization, assigning leaders to categories according to their formal positions only. The top leadership refers to all persons who ever belonged to the Central Committee or the Foreign Committee or attended a conference of the Bund. These institutions included the most talented and dedicated participants of the organization. The Central Committee was the highest executive body within the Bund. The Foreign Committee fulfilled the same function abroad. It should be noted that the overlap of membership of these institutions was very high, top leaders having served frequently on both of them at one time or another. The conferences of the Bund generally served the very significant function of preliminary policy formulation. Out of our sample of 154 Bund members, 50 persons belong in this category of top leadership. Below this level, a second echelon of 53 persons consists of those who attended congresses, served as members of local committees, or as editorial staff of local Bund journals. The remaining group of 51 members includes active participants in the Bund who did not hold formal positions in the organization, but whose work as activists merited attention in various sources consulted. Their work included transport of illegal literature, running study groups, agitation, building illegal libraries, and a variety of related activities. Second, we have classified leaders and active members according to their roles in the movement, regardless of the formal positions they held. Here we have distinguished the members who engaged primarily in cultural, or educational activities or in political or journalistic writing from members who are primarily devoted to the technical and executive aspects of organization. Finally, as a third method of classification, we have sorted the leaders and active members according to the nature and extent of their formal education. In one broad category, we include all who had formal secular education in gymnasia or universities, and in another category, all who had received only Hebrew schooling or who had no formal education in Russia. By sorting out the active members according to these three criteria, by level of formal leadership position, by cultural or organizational roles in the movement, and by educational background, it is possible to describe the leadership of the Bund on an analytical plane. Our analysis begins with differences in education among the leaders of the Bund. These differences have the greatest significance in determining the level of formal positions which leaders held and the roles which they played in the revolutionary movement. Beyond this, and even more importantly, these differences in education reveal the structure of the Bund as an organization, and they show how it was possible for it to be so highly effective in spreading its revolutionary ideology to the Jewish working class. The responsibility for this mission had been assumed by Jewish social democratic intellectuals even before the founding of the Bund. In our sample of active Bundists, the persons whose education would assuredly entitle them to be called intellectuals are those who attended gymnasia or universities. And we class as non-intellectuals all persons who did not have this education. For the most part, the educational attainment of the non-intellectuals can be regarded as equivalent to that of the Jewish working masses. Thus, by examining the education of Bund leaders at different levels of formal position, can be shown how the organization served as a mechanism whereby intellectuals made contact with the Jewish working class. Higher secular education appears to me most important at the highest levels of formal position. On the Central Committee, out of 19 persons for whom information has thus far become available, 13 are intellectuals. Among the 50 persons who constitute the top leadership, including the Central Committee, 30 or 60% are intellectuals. But in the second echelon, a striking difference appears. Out of 53 persons, only 16 or 30% are intellectuals. These findings show how intellectuals and non-intellectuals were joined together in the organization. Even at the highest levels of formal leadership, non-intellectuals were active and assumed responsibility for revolutionary tasks. The existence of an organization made it possible and necessary for intellectuals and non-intellectuals alike to work together and depend on each other. In this way, the organization fostered a sense of personal commitment that could not be developed by indoctrination alone. Moreover, the contrast between the top leadership, where intellectuals formed the majority, and the second echelon, where they were in a minority, sheds light on the different functions performed at each level. The responsibilities of second echelon leaders were primarily local. Even as delegates to Congresses, they represented local Bund committees or organizations. They held autonomous control of local revolutionary activities, although it must be added that they also served as communication links between the Central Committee and members of the Jewish communities. The tasks at the second echelon did not require formal secular education so much as they required intimate knowledge of local conditions, personal relationships of mutual trust with local Bund members and interested residents, and the ability to mobilize local support in inconspicuous ways. The kind of proficiency most valuable for members of the second echelon now calls attention to differences among Bund leaders according to the roles they played in the revolutionary movement. These differences in role are apparent from the highest to the lowest levels of leadership. The Central Committee, for example, could not function effectively without members who were adept in the executive tasks of coordination, in planning strategy and tactics, in anticipating the contingencies of the Bund's formal relationship with other revolutionary parties. Nor could the Central Committee function without members who knew intimately the nature of the technical tasks which had to be carried out everywhere the Bund functioned. At all levels of leadership positions, persons were present whose talents were eminently suited to these tasks. For analytical purposes, such leaders can be classified as having a technical or executive role in the movement. In contrast, are those leaders who devoted their energies to educational or cultural work, journalistic or political writing. Such persons can be designated as having a cultural role. Our understanding of the Bund as an organization will be enhanced by showing how leaders who served in these different roles were distributed among levels of formal position and how these role differences are related to education. It should be clear, of course, that executive or technical and cultural roles are not mutually exclusive. Many leaders are found in both roles, but the number of these persons is hard to determine thus far. Our information is always more definite about an individual's cultural role than it is about his executive or technical role. Strictly speaking, this classification of leaders by roles is based on whether they did or did not engage in cultural types of activity. However, if a person held a formal leadership position but had no cultural role, it can safely be assumed that his role was executive or technical. The proportion of leaders in cultural roles varies according to levels of leadership position. In the top leadership, for example, among the 19 members of the Central Committee, 15 have cultural roles. In the top leadership as a whole, including the Central Committee, 39 of the 50 leaders, or 78%, have cultural roles. By contrast, in the second echelon, cultural roles are performed by only 28 of the 53 leaders, or 52%. The lower proportion of cultural roles in the second echelon may be a consequence of the functions required at this level. However, the education of the leaders appears also to have an effect on whether they perform cultural roles or not. For example, among those leaders at both levels who have had no formal or Hebrew education, we find the smallest proportion of those with cultural roles. In all other educational categories, the proportion with cultural roles is more than half. But for the 30 leaders without formal education, only 11 have cultural roles. The effect of education on cultural roles is, however, not so simple as the comparisons thus far would imply. The active Bundists who did not have formal secular education, but who did have Hebrew schooling, stand out in our findings as a distinctive group. At all levels of the organization, their participation in cultural roles is consistently high. Of 27 leaders with this education, in top leadership and second echelon combined, 19 had cultural roles. This proportion holds true as well among Bundists who held no formal leadership positions. 19 of these had Hebrew schooling only, and of this number, 15 had cultural roles. On the other hand, 11 Bundists at this level had no formal schooling, and only 5 of these were in cultural roles. This high proportion of cultural roles among Bundists with Hebrew schooling only needs to be more fully examined. Persons with this education had a relatively small share of top leadership positions. Through cultural roles, however, these persons could play a part in the movement that committed them to the organization just as effectively as if they had formal leadership positions. At the same time, Hebrew schooling did not produce social distance from the masses as formal secular education might have done. On the contrary, it enabled them to communicate with the working masses in forms which they could understand readily. Through members with Hebrew schooling, therefore, the Bund was able to forge a link with the masses which made it such a power to be reckoned with in the revolutionary movement. The analysis of leadership by reference to role, education, and formal position is but one approach to the study of organization. New perspectives emerge if we consider the effects of historical change in the internal dynamics of the Bund. Historical circumstances affected the size and quality of Bund leadership. They affected the balance of tasks which the organization had to undertake. The long-term existence of the Bund itself produced conditions affecting the mobility of persons within the organization and the turnover of its leaders. A striking example of what is yielded by the dynamic approach is the impressive stability of the Bund's leadership under illegal conditions. By stability, we mean continuous long-term service in top leadership positions. Out of the 50 persons who held posts at this level between 1897 and March 1917, exactly half, or 25, had first held these positions before 1905. Another 19 had first held their positions by 1906, and only 6 had reached top leadership positions for the first time after that year. Of the 25 who formed the top leadership before 1905, 10 were still in top leadership positions in the period from 1911 to March 1917. The importance of the continuity of their service becomes convincing when their names are cited. They include Vladimir Kosovsky, Noach Portnoy, Rachmiel Weinstein, Beinisch Mikhailievich, Pavel Rosenthal, Fischl Koigen, Isaiah Eisenstadt Juden, Mark Lieber, Vladimir Medem, and Raphael Abramovich. The persistence of this group alone shows not only the stability to be found in Bund leadership, but also the solidarity of the movement as a whole up to the revolution. Earlier in this paper, we noted that the cohesiveness of the Bund has been recognized as one of its most distinctive features. We have tried to account for this fact by a systematic analysis of its leadership without assuming that this tells the whole story. Our findings also show that the Bund did not give rise to any single charismatic leader who, by his extraordinary personal qualities, came to dominate the organization and determine its character. Moreover, the Bund, up to 1917, was relatively free from internal schisms. Since many Jewish social movements arose out of the same milieu, this raises a question which still remains to be answered, and we won't answer it tonight. Was the leadership of the Bund different from the leadership of other movements? If it was, what conditions could account for the difference? Thank you.
By all means.
Yeah. I have one note that I would like to add. Since Professor Woodhouse, who accompanied me from the University of New Mexico, is here, and he is perhaps the newest of the initiates into the study of Jewish social movements in Russia, and a co-author of the paper, and in addition to which, who has exhibited enormous staying power in listening to papers in which he understood little of the language, we would be appreciative if comments addressed to the paper might be made in English so that he would also have an opportunity to reply to criticism. Thank you.